for plebs by plebs, dropping the Bitcoin only signal. Pleb Underground. Welcome everyone to the Pleb Underground.
Pleb Underground, I'm recording while away. Episode 67, Pleb Culture Not Au Fait, with bad privacy, disclosure, 0 day, don't use ledger, have no hero, slay. Self-reflection, not just egos, health inspection, no trust, she goes. Bitcoin not a trap, it's not a beat like Migos. Not gunning tequila, fuck a casa with amigos. Make it up on the fly, blagger, 40,000 feet high, bagger. Straps, not shy, gagger. Raps cut like a dagger. Fuck an API call. You want the HAPPY full. Can't buy it in the do you buy more? Is this a super cycle? Still writing words. Some call me a rapper. Sign with NFC. Easy tapper. After the show, it's time to clap her. Sober presence. No gift for the trapper. You know me, the MC in Atlanta. Bitcoin joker. I call it sap banter. Ready to soak her. She'll need a flannel. Crude lines croak through my finest anal. I'm still cutting, even at my waist. Drive hard, then putting. Don't let it go to waste. Gotta be original. Can't copy paste. Deliberate, not rushed. Never act in haste. Act upon your principles, otherwise you're faced with the true reality. Are you really based? Kiss the cute girl, better get a taste. Appropriately framed, outfit always laced. Ordinal, nominal, categorical. Almost all shitcoiners don't understand the oracle. Problems can't be solved with automation. Bitcoin uses probabilistic approximation. Bitcoin like the gym, it needs more reps. Learn before you talk, take baby steps. Sugar and lemon, drizzle the creps. Then wrap it up, she intercepts. Your peace of mind, it's a must feel. A piece of cake, mind, ain't no meal. A limited lake, mind, not ideal. Be in charge, no need to kneel. I just checked in, joking from room 402. Haven't been smoking, more room for O2. Get the winter sun for the wind to run. Fresh ideas, not falling on special ears. Blowing wind to none. Growing, tweet pinned, have fun. Take a trip, get some heat. Full decline, like my seat. No longer wheezy, this ain't lung money. Not left holding, call it hung money. Fuck shit coins, there's none I'd rather. Lucky her, she calls me her father. Is she a work of art? Does she belong in MoMA? My advice, you're not Bart. Don't be a simp, son. No Homer. Maybe this is your start. Remember, when in Roma, find your drive, grab a cart. Go at your pace, can't end with a coma. It's Bitcoin, you know, you should be long. We're back with new hits from the song.
Boom. Walton. Amazing. Amazing. And that's right, guys. Joining us today, very special guest, Bitcoin expert. You may have heard of him, Jimmy Song. Jimmy, thank you very much for joining us on Pleb Underground. It's a huge honor.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on a show like this, and I'm not really familiar with what you guys do, so that was a little bit of a shock what I heard at the beginning, but that was cool.
We appreciate it. Hopefully we're not going to freak you out too much. But yeah, it's a Bitcoin Pleb show, and we're going to dive right into it, guys. We are going to move it on over to the numbers.
Yeah, the numbers, of course, brought to us by Time Chain Stats and Time Chain Calendar. Phil, what do the numbers look like this week?
At the time of this recording, the block height is 821,340. The Bitcoin fiat exchange, 41,919. Total public lightning capacity, 5,101. Moscow time, 2385. Fastest fee, 192 sats per V-byte. Days to the halving, 129. And guys, our chain rewrite days, 715. Those are the numbers. Very uneventful numbers, I think. Walton? Eventful, uneventful. I feel like we're saying the same numbers every week.
I think one new number we need to start including, though, is the mean fee rate, or the highest fee rate, because it's a number that I've been following a little bit, and to me it's still too high, right? You've got, like, it's funny, we said we want, you know, 20 what is it, like 20 for like 5 years until this year, everyone's saying, oh yeah, bring all the shit coins onto Bitcoin. I don't know if it's a great idea, right? Like, it's the, you know, the there are, you know, blocks being mined, there's transactions going through, but if you want to consolidate UTXOs, now is no longer the time, right?
Yeah, it's pretty expensive. It's pretty expensive to consolidate your UTXOs right now. And actually, it's very interesting that you talk about bringing the shitcoiners to Bitcoin, because I was actually just sitting in a space, a Humble Warrior space. And she had David Bailey on stage, right? And of course, David is a, you know, supporter of ordinals to a certain extent. And obviously, right, one of his points was, what would you rather they do? Would you rather they go to this casino and do it on Ethereum, or would you rather they do it on Bitcoin? And Jimmy,
I've been saying for weeks, is it's like we've got a pain drives technological innovation, and it's clear we need some, you know, some better batching of transactions. We need some better scaling solutions now, and I think it's going to drive some of that. But I think it's funny, there are, like we talked about this BRC20, it's easy for people to do, and that's why people are doing it, and that's clogging the mempool. But with some of these other things, I'm concerned about, like UTXO set getting bloated, right? Like stamps, things like this. There's you know, that aren't necessarily prunable. Or
it's really kind of a disingenuous argument. It's not whether you want them to gamble here or there, this casino or that casino. I mean, just because they set up like in your mall or something does not make them more legit. I think they're really, really stupid. And the people that are running it, they're using VC money to do all of this. In a sense, this is kind of unavoidable as long as VC money is out there chasing stuff like this, which I think is highly immoral, but I think a lot of VCs are highly immoral anyway. So they're going to do this. They're going to hope for some sort of hype or whatever. And unfortunately, the people that suffer from Bitcoin derangement syndrome, these are the people that are most likely to support ordinals and sort of like stick it to the Bitcoiners that actually care about Bitcoin and, you know, sort of grief them in some weird DOS attack on the Bitcoin network. But, you know, as they say, all of this too will pass, and they'll try this and lose a bunch of money. Probably won't suffer too many consequences other than just completely losing their reputation in the space, which I think they fully deserve. But you know, this is what they're paying for. A lot of these guys have been like Bitcoin derangement syndrome people for years. So, in a sense, maybe it's worth having the mempool clogged a little bit so we could get rid of them.
You know what? I agree with you on all those points, but I also heard Udi made the argument that the reason why they're doing this, right, is because this is a, you know, for Bitcoin adoption. What are your thoughts on that? Because personally, I think that that's absolute nonsense. To me, like, I get that it's this lower barrier of entry. Okay, fair enough, but it's grifting, right? You're bringing people in under the unsuspecting idea that they're quote unquote investing or storing some type of value in this, you know, JPEG garbage or whatever. But really, really, they have absolutely nothing. They're just paying for like a pointer, right? Like, so anyways, what are your thoughts on the whole, like, it's bringing adoption to Bitcoin, and that kind of validates it, right? The net positive argument, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, and I've heard this argument since like the beginning of altcoins or whatever. It's this idea that, you know, all Bitcoin just needs is a little better marketing, and we'll be at like $20 trillion or something. And that's just not the case. And we've been observing this space for a very long time. The way people come to own and store Bitcoin and hold it is not any of these other narratives, including the one that you just said of, oh, you just need lots of people to, you know, get into Bitcoin, you know, no matter what the path is. And we've been observing this for a long time. It's not like just a bunch of Bitcoin accepted here stickers and, you know, observing a Bitcoin ATM and seeing a couple commercials that turns people into Bitcoin maximalists. That's very far from the case. In fact, most of the people that get in that way end up in like altcoin casinos and losing a lot of money and getting scammed and then saying, oh, you know what, I'm swearing this space off forever. And, you know, I mean, it could have helped a ton of people, especially in developing countries and whatnot. But instead, it, you know, you've just made them slaves of Silicon Valley in some way, shape or form. And that's what's happened. And and this narrative of adoption being driven by making it easier to get in, that is definitely not the case. In fact, I think it should be a little bit harder to get in. The easier you kind of make it, I mean, you might get a little bit of a higher funnel, but you know, at the top, but like people don't go all the way down to the bottom because in a sense they don't understand the significance of money and so on. So that's why.
One further question on this, just for Jimmy. Like, I think your theory is that they're going to run out of money, but if this, I don't know, has the attention of the state, like at what point do they run out of money? Like, if the state really want to, I say the state, right? If governments, those that have a lot of power in the fiat world, a lot of money in the fiat world, if they really want to make it, you know, unusable for a period of time for a lot of normal people, like is that a problem?
Well, here's the thing about doing something like that. If they become sort of like that buyer, you got to pay fees for all this. So if they become that buyer that continually subsidizes these Bitcoin transactions and essentially miners, then they're going to have to spend exponentially more money as Bitcoin price goes up. So right now it's relatively cheap, I guess. I mean, you can probably spend, a couple $100,000 a block, and that's plenty of money to, not even a couple $100,000. I guess fees right now are about 1.5 to 2 Bitcoin per block. Say 2 Bitcoin, that's about $85,000 to grief a block, and probably significantly less than that. Maybe half of that if you want to like keep the fee pressure on and so on. But if you do that for like a whole day, even like $20,000 to $40,000 times 144, I mean that's well over $1 million a day. It's not cheap. And as Bitcoin price rises based on that buy pressure, even assuming that like miners sell everything, you're adding a lot of buy pressure into Bitcoin that causes the price to rise. And if the price continues to rise, then it gets more expensive and so on. It's a vicious feedback loop. So you may get like a serious frenzy going, and that's it's one of the nice things about Bitcoin. There are economic incentives that cause things to go make it very expensive for people that would DOS your system.
Absolutely. And speaking of which, I just want to, I'm going to pull up a link here before we wrap up the numbers. This was shared by Walton. This is the, right, we're talking about adoption, right? And this is part of the whole entire grifting narrative that, all these JPEGs and all this stuff's going to bring adoption. So look, this is the cell phones versus BTC addresses. Thank you, Walton, for providing us the log version of it. And just to give you an idea, here's the BTC addresses all the way down here, and take a look at the cell phone subscription service, subscriptions worldwide. So this absolute nonsense that we need to stick garbage on the Bitcoin blockchain in order to create adoption. And I know, I understand the garbage is subjective, right? This is what's being drilled into us every single day out there. It's subjective. You see it as garbage, but guys, it's exactly what Jimmy said. And it's exactly what we're all saying. Like, you don't need this. You definitely do not need this. And actually, in the Hopium segment, I am going to have some further information on that. Anyways, guys.
The reason this chart is because it's not trying to say that addresses are people. Similarly, it's not trying to say mobile phones are people, right? You can have one person could have multiple mobile phone subscriptions. There will be some people who are sharing, a mobile phone contract between a couple of people. And the same thing is true with Bitcoin addresses, right? And so therefore it's kind of a good comparison, I think.
Yeah, absolutely right. Guys, that's going to wrap up the numbers, and we are going to move it on over to the Fireside Chat. The Fireside Chat is brought to you by BTC Pins. Check them out at btcpins.com. They make awesome Bitcoin pins. They also make really cool stickers, and they have awesome accessories. As always, I like to show my pin collection. That's right. The new Pleb Underground pin is available on btcpins.com. Use the code PlebUnderground for 5% off at btcpins.com. Welcome back, everyone, to the Fireside Chat. And Jimmy, here we go. We are going to dive into it. You have created some of the most incredible Bitcoin resources to date. And as of right now, you've got a brand new book that just came out called Fiat Ruins Everything. And I want to dive into it because I, you know, when I took a look at it, it just seemed to me like this is like one of these types of books that can kind of catch all different types of people from all different angles, right? It's not just coming from one perspective. It seems to be coming out from multiple perspectives, right? And I don't know if you can kind of share, you know, some tidbits about it.
Yeah. So I wrote the book actually not intending it to be like an evangelical book, right? Like to get people into Bitcoin. I've certainly written a lot of books along those lines, you know, for given different audiences. For this one, I wanted to target, you know, people that watch the show, right? Like the Bitcoin maximalists, the people that have been in Bitcoin a while, and rally the troops a little bit and show them, okay, this is a just cause that we are, you know, fighting against, right? This is a part of doing the right thing and making the world better for people, because fiat really has ruined everything. And in the book, I talk a lot about the, you know, many different ways in which fiat has ruined things, you know, at the individual, company, nation, and you know, global levels. And, you know, there's a lot of things. It touches on all kinds of topics, from education to beliefs to morals to science to, you know,
health, food.
I didn't quite cover as much on the health and food. I think Safedean's done a remarkable job on that. But you know, there's a lot of different aspects of modern society that I touch on in the book.
So one of the you know, I think one of the points that you bring up right away is the point of education. And I have to admit, this has been a sticking point for me ever since I was a kid. Essentially, you kind of explained, at least from my perspective, growing up in Canada, I was just explained the government prints money and that's it. Like, that's just where it stops. The government prints money and you're done, right? Like, I remember even asking my dad, you know, like about that. And I'm like, why? And he's like, Phil, that's just how it works. And that's what they take. They kind of take it for granted. So I guess in my question is, why is it so difficult for us to educate people on the fact that money is broke? Like, I guess, you know, what is it that makes it that the average person just seemingly doesn't want to believe this or doesn't care? Or
yeah, there's a degree of you know, like indoctrination that happens throughout most of our education journey, right? And so much of what you're rewarded for in a fiat economy is compliance to others, and particularly in school. Like most teachers give out grades not based on your knowledge of the subject. They give out grades based on your behavior in class and, you know, whether you do, you know, what they say and so on, which is kind of like, you know, it's not a very good measurement of like how much of an expert you are now at like this particular subject. It's just, you know, how willing are you to get along with other people or go along with whatever they say? So there's a significant amount of that, which sort of shuts off intellectual inquiry. You have to accept certain things. And we saw sort of at a societal level, like what the consequences of that were. I mean, there weren't that many people like questioning, oh, we do need to lock things down and we need, you know, 2 weeks to stop the script spread. Oh, no, 4 weeks. Oh, no, 4 months. No, 2 years. You know, they just kind of they kept moving the goalposts and everyone at least in the mainstream, kind of went along with it because they were so used to it. So there's a deep comfort, I think, for people that have been indoctrinated in not questioning the official narrative. And even to this day, there's a lot of people that just don't question the lockdowns at all. They don't even want to think about it. They just sort of say, okay, well, that's what it was. And, you know, it kind of happened. They don't question the system that led to it, the tyranny. they just go, well, you know, it happened and it's over now. And I'm not going to think about it. Or even like the people that took the vax, you know, they're seeing, okay, well, yeah, it didn't cause me to be more immune to the disease. In fact, it made me more likely to catch COVID. There are all kinds of health complications that come along with it. They don't want to hear any of that, right? Like they don't want to re-examine belief. They would rather just keep going on about it. And this points to like a deeper thing that happens on their fiat money, which is that politics ends up trumping any sort of merit. And that's, you know, basically what I describe with like school grades and so on. But once politics sort of like takes center stage, then it's not about how well you do something. It's about how well you please your boss. And that's ultimately what a lot of people end up becoming very good at. And if you know anybody that's good at school, that's ultimately what they were, is they knew how to play the game of politics of, you know, massaging this person's, this teacher's ego and, you know, like playing the right game so that they got the right, right grades. And you still have to be smart to do that, I suppose, but it's a very different kind of smart than the, you know, kind that say Nikola Tesla had. And that's really the problem here, is that a lot of people don't want to question things because that's how they've been taught. And it's in many ways on their fiat system way more profitable to go along with lies than to question and discover the truth.
Yeah,
Jimmy, I like these thoughts. They match some ideas that I've talked about on the show extensively. To me, I look at you mentioned behavior in school. To me, due to the time theft from the parents, you have both parents having to work full time, having less time to support each other and having less time to do some parenting or to do consistent parenting. And so there is more responsibility on public schooling and this sort of thing to do that sort of thing. And so then, yeah, it's unsurprising that there is maybe worse behavior in class. And then the education system tries to respond to that. And another point you made was about how certain traits are being selected. The term I used to refer to this is political quotient. So you have intellectual quotient, emotional quotient, and political quotient. And political quotient is the ability of individuals to influence others to make things appear a certain way rather than necessarily doing the work. It's the proof of stake type behavior. And I think you see this all through society. Why? Because the politicians at the top do well by lying. They don't have to collect the tax money to pay for things that they want to pay for. They print the difference and they gaslight people about money. And then the people who do well with government contracts, again, are the people who are able to liaise well with these kind of high PQ individuals. And so you have organizations throughout society selecting for people that have high political quotient.
Yeah, and those are the people that succeed. That's kind of the idea, is that every CEO of a major company, they're more political officer than entrepreneur, right? They're very good at satisfying government bureaucrats, paying off the right people, and so on. This has had a profoundly bad effect on not just all of these organizations, but on the new generation coming up and so on. And just the point about education and sort of like forcing us to pay for public schooling, whether we want it or not, a lot of the pressures that families now have is they are significantly poorer than we were, say, like 60 years ago. And a lot of that is, you know, sort of gaslit and spun as women's liberation or something like that. But the fact that both parents have to work almost everywhere in the world is due to the fact that there's so much rent seeking and bureaucracy and grifting off of fiat money that this is the necessity at this point, right? Like, you know, not only are we having to work, you know, two jobs to, you know, support even like one kid or something like that, we're being gaslit to believe that this is somehow like good for us, right? Like somehow this is more freedom for people when really we're enslaved. And that's the real tragedy, is that the propaganda goes so deep, the political aspect goes so deep that we don't recognize what would be obvious to pretty much anybody, you know, in the last 200 years.
And the don't same forget, families every... that Seth, oh. Sorry, go on, Phil.
No, I was going to say, and don't forget, every failure is personal, right? Like it's your own as a parent, right? It's your failure if it doesn't work out, you know. Mm-hmm. But I actually wanted to switch gears over to it's not really entirely switching gears, but partially.
Just briefly, then, Phil.
Okay, go ahead, Walton.
To me, like a key thing is that the families that founded and own central banks are the same ones that pushed a lot of research and pushed a lot of feminism and the empowerment of women. So it's not that women have to, you know, work, or that both adults have to work. It's, you know, man, whatever. Mm. It's both adults have to work. Oh no, it's empowering if both adults have to work, right? It's the PSYOP is paid for the people that print the money, the people that own the printing of the money.
It's a slavery trick. I mean, if you think about it, right? Like it's right. It's just like the Matrix said, you know, it's a prison. You can't touch, taste or smell, you know, and you think that you're coming up with these things and that they're your own ideas. And this is what I want as an individual. It's like you just got grifted into a narrative that destroys the atomic family. That's all. It's like really that's what it is. But I just wanted to switch gears to talk about art, because this is kind of a topic that I've thought about extensively. And okay, so I mean, I think to us as Bitcoiners, right, it's no surprise that shitty money has created increasingly shitty art, because I don't think we any longer have the, not the capacity, but because our money doesn't retain its value, we essentially can't create things of value and or quality. And I just wanted to know,
the last kind of couple decades, 2-3 decades, music's definitely worse than it has been. It's not just that we're getting older, right, Phil?
No, yeah, exactly. Or is it? Because now I feel like we sound like our parents. So Jimmy, I just wanted to know what was your view on essentially like the debasement of art, and does Bitcoin fix this, right? Do we think?
Yeah.
Bitcoin
so, fixes? So this is the chapter fiat debases art. And yeah, I literally like wrote a whole chapter on it, and it's the only chapter where I had to put in some sort of trigger warning, because honestly, discussion about art like really triggers people. Like artists in particular really hate it when I criticize Picasso, for example. And that's how that chapter begins, about how much I hate Picasso and how I think it's a piece of crap. And he's like the ultimate in like a proof of stake artist. And that's the thing to realize about art, is that it's moved from proof of work to proof of stake. So if you look at La Pietà, right, like one of the greatest statues ever made, and it's in the Vatican, it's of Mary holding Jesus after, you know, he's come down from the cross. And there have been many interpretations of La Pietà in many different works, but that's probably the greatest one that was ever made. And the story I tell about this is that you know, Michelangelo was in his early 20s when he made that statue, and not many people knew who he was or whatever. So, you know, he made the statue and people were looking at it, I believe, at, you know, wherever it was happened to be displayed. And he was just sort of hanging back and seeing what people's reactions would be. And people were looking at it and they were asking, OK, what master did this? Right. Like, you know, oh, it must be this person. It must be this person. And they didn't know who he was. So And they didn't know that it was him. So later that night, after observing all of these people, he actually carved his name into Mary's sash. And you can clearly see it in that piece of art. And later on, he really regretted doing this, right? Signing his name on this amazing piece of art. And he always felt like it was a part of his vanity that caused him to do that. And he never signed anything that he did ever again. And, you know, like all of the other stuff that he made, Sistine Chapel, David, you know, that's a statue of Moses and so on. He never signed anything again. And it was because he felt like the work should speak for itself. And if you've ever been to Rome, a lot of works like that. You look at, you know, St. John the Lateran, one of the really most gorgeous churches I've ever been to, but because it's in Rome, very few people know about it. There are these enormous statues of each apostle, and none of them have a single signature next to them, right? Like you have no idea who made them. So it's all proof of work. It's just, you're supposed to appreciate it for what it is rather than who made it. Now, contrast that to something like Picasso. And honestly, like a lot of the things that he makes, your five-year-old can make. The only reason that the Picasso version is worth anything is because of his signature, because he's proven that he's the one that made it. It's not because of the more artistic merit. It's because of who signed it. And this is how art works now, is it's all about the artist and not about the art itself. And that's been the case because of fiat money, where in anything political, it's not about what is said. It's about who says it, right? Like, it's not about the idea at all. It's about, you know, the person in authority or whatever. So you get this weird dynamic where in order to become, you know, a really good artist, it's not about making things more beautiful or more interesting or like whatever. It's way more about climbing the political ladder of that particular hierarchy. So in the art world, if you want to be sort of like at the top of that heap, then that's the game you have to play. It's a political game where if you are one of the, you know, more famous artists, then your work sells no matter what, right? Like, because it's a proof of stake world, right? Like Andy Warhol, I think, is trash, but, you know, people will pay a lot of money for it because he's famous. And that's the value of that piece, is the person that it's associated with. And there's a wonderful book that you can read more about, like with respect to the art world and the specifics of how, you know, things get priced and stuff like that. It's called The $8 Million Shark. And it's about this art piece where this guy basically stuffed a shark skin in and put it in formaldehyde. And this became, you know, he sold it for some amount of money and then they resold it and it ended up like fetching $8 million at auction. It's like, why did this thing, like, it's kind of like, it's something that any taxidermist probably could have done, but somehow this became this $8 million thing. And, you know, it gets into a lot of really weird stuff about the modern art world that you get to know. But ultimately, it's just like a lot of things in fiat, which is that it's driven by politics and a lot of the new money that's coming in. And, you know, the money that gets printed from nothing ends up funding a lot of this stuff. And it's in a weird way, it gives hope to people that have no talent and gives but are very good at politics. And this is something that you find out with the $8 million shark. Like, all of the top artists, they're all marketers, right? They're very good at playing politics.
And high PQ.
Yeah, yeah. They do not understand how to, they're not like necessarily good artists. In fact, like, you know, one of the things that you learn is a lot of these quote unquote artists with like the big name, they hire art school graduates, right? Like 20 at a time, and they do the actual work of creating the piece. And they say, oh, you know, I'm more the concept person. I can't actually draw, right? Like that's how
That's what happens with scientists in labs, right? Like all the postdocs do the real work, but the professor is the one with the name, you know, first on the paper.
And this is what's happening in the art world. And you know, I've had lots of criticisms of the art itself and how, you know, it doesn't look like anything. And you know, there's another podcast where basically I laid all of that argument out, as well as in the book itself. But yeah, it's one of those areas where it's gotten deeply deeply corrupted by fiat money. Now, like, you know, fine art pieces that you hang in the museum, I think that's like the most corrupted, you know, with Picasso's and Jackson Pollock's and stuff. The other thing, the art that you guys mentioned about music and it being derivative and so on, I mean, there's some degree of politics there. But here's the thing. It doesn't go so far as like atonal music, right? And I don't know if you've ever heard atonal music, but that is the shittiest thing you'll ever hear, right? Like that is what I would compare to a Picasso. Like Picassos are just not visually interesting to look at. It's true. It revolts you, right? And atonal music is very much like that. It's just notes all over the place. Might as well just be random noise. And you can't listen to it, but with at least pop music and stuff like that, it has to have a tune, something that'll get stuck in your head. Now, granted, it's sort of like
for the masses, right? Whereas if you have the art, I think it's because you can't save in fiat, right? There's monetary premiums on everything, and art is something that you can, you know, sell to yourself or sell to your friend, and it's a shitcoin, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a money laundering aspect to it. But I mean, my point basically being is that there's only a certain degree of corruption that the public will take with respect to music, because it's like the background track in a lot of music and stuff in movies and all kinds of stuff. You need to still be able to dance to it, for example, they can't corrupt it that much. Now, that said, I think there's been certainly a significant corrupting of music. And I mean, like, I used to live in Boston, and I knew like a bunch of like Berkeley grad students. Some of them are incredible musicians and have 20 times the talent of like a lot of people that you see in pop music or whatever. Yeah. But pop music like has become kind of this like hybrid thing where the marketing and the image matters just as much, if not more, than the actual music itself. And there are incredibly good tools at making pretty much anybody into a good singer through auto-tuning and like mixing and like you know, putting in beats on the back end and you know, sort of melding it with something else more familiar so that it'll be more acceptable to other people and so on. That, you know, this process has become more or less like, you know, it's been made into like a line process, right? Like an assembly line process where you sort of like layer on stuff, which is why so much stuff like kind of sounds generic. But, you know, like it's at the minimum threshold of acceptability in many cases. And the rest of it is there to kind of sell you on something fiat related. And it does become a political marketing game to a large degree, which is, you know, it's tragic to me that so many people, like, I remember watching this like VH1 show way back in the day, maybe 20 years ago. And, you know, it was talking about alternative music or whatever, and not alt rock, like, you know, grunge music or something, but it was just like, you know, these niche things. And they were asking this woman like, oh, how'd you get into it? Or how do you select the music? She's like, well, I make sure to go read the reviews for the music first from the magazines I like, right? It's not at all about merit. It's about sort of like a proof of stake from some leading. It's about governance. Like political in-group, right? And that I discovered is thing. I think a large part of like these music scenes. It's not about like how great a particular thing is, or about like merit or whatever. It's much more about like the in-group signaling of the people around it, and that ends up making something popular. And again, you can't, there's a certain degree where, you know, like people just won't accept it. If it's atonal music, I mean, they're like, it's going to be very hard to bring mainstream. And ironically enough, like the only place where, you know, merit does seem to kind of be a thing is like hardcore battle rap, right? Like where it really is like kind of like a competition, and the better disses and end up winning, and you have this competition of diss tracks or something like that. Whereas anything like kind of pop related, it's not so much that. And in that sense, like, you know, at least something like K-pop is like, it's highly artificial and it is very much an assembly line process, but at least there's merit involved, right? Like the kids that can dance the best and sing the best make it to the top because they sign these contracts and so on. But, you know, I mean, that this is the state of art, is that so much of it ends up going towards stuff that's politically driven and less merit driven.
Absolutely, man. And guys, if you want to know more about this, don't forget to check out Fiat Ruins Everything. And Jimmy, where can they find you? Where can the viewers and listeners find the book?
Yeah, you can find this book on Amazon, on Bitcoin Magazine's website, and my website, fiatruinseverything.com, if you want a signed copy. But yeah, it's available in a lot of places, and yeah, you can just it's available as an audiobook, ebook, soft cover, and hardcover through my website. So there you go.
Very cool, very cool. We are going to add those links to the show notes for the viewers. And guys, this wraps up our fireside chat, and we are going to move it on over to Wrecked.
Up next, we have Wrecked, sponsored by Represent. Represent are a Bitcoin-owned clothing brand based in the United States of America. And if you head over to their website, representltd.com, you can find a wide selection of apparel and accessories, shirts that look almost as cool as this limited edition piece I'm currently wearing. And if you use the code PLEBUNDERGROUND, you can get a discount on all of the goodies. Once again, that's representltd.com. And here a tweet from a guy that we sacrificed to kick off the bull market, my friend Rindahl. He says, want to prevent a permissionless internet money from challenging your national currency. The most effective attack is to convince people not to use it for commerce. The attack has not come through hash rage. It's come through tax policy and books and podcasts.
Okay.
Gentlemen, do we think the HODL meme, the HODL culture is... an attack on Bitcoin? Do you think it's preventing people using it for commerce? To me, it's a misunderstanding, right? The HODL was more about, well, don't sell it. It doesn't mean don't spend it, but is the HODL meme destructive at this point?
No, absolutely not. this is where technical people tend to think that they know what they're talking about in the economic realm. And this is one of those economic questions. What's more effective? And we killed this, like, you know, commerce, method of payment meme a long time ago. And I think for me, when it died was 2013, the day that Ross Ulbricht was arrested. I think it was October 1st, 2013. So almost 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago, this happened. And the narrative up to that time was Bitcoin is useful because it's darknet, currency for transactions. And, you know, they can't, you know, it's very difficult to control there, and therefore it is better. But what was proved over the next 6 weeks with a rise in Bitcoin from $100 to $1,100 was that wasn't the real reason why Bitcoin was valuable. The reason was because there's this scarcity and store of value aspect to it. And for him to like just sort of assert this, it just comes from bad economic thinking. And a lot of technologists actually fall into this, especially like Silicon Valley people. they don't understand Austrian economics. So they assert stupid stuff like, oh, you know, if we just get past a certain velocity, then, you know, it's over. Then, you know, enough people are using Bitcoin that it'll continue and stuff. You have to understand, like, the laws of economics. Like, people don't want to spend the good money. They want to spend the bad money. And that's just kind of what's happening with HODL, you know, this meet of HODL, like, you know, moralizing and saying, oh, you know, Bitcoiners should spend more money and use the network to, you know, prevent the mining death spiral or something like that. These completely do not get the point, and they don't understand economics. And, you know, like, this guy is a technical guy, and if he opined on something technical, I would listen to him. But, like, anything economic, do not listen to technical people, especially VCs, because they are either stupid, right? Don't understand the economics, which many of them are, and you're going to get wrecked because of that. Or they are malicious, in which case they might understand the economics, but they have no interest in telling you because they're pumping their bags. So all that's to say that this is something that I see very often. You need both. You need the technical understanding and an economic understanding to really get Bitcoin. This guy does not get the economic understanding.
Okay, so for the next story on Wrecked, so the last couple of weeks there's been an ongoing discussion about, you know, ocean mining and knots, and are they censoring, and should it be about freedom of choice? And to me, the bigger discussion is it's more about whether you believe that Bitcoin can be broken, or whether things can be built around it. But I want to share a couple of tweets here from some other people that have another idea, that actually maybe this conversation is actually just a distraction. Maybe this conversation is about derailing more important things like activation of CTV. And an individual here, Randomal, believes that the CIA is behind every red herring in Bitcoin, because distraction is such a good form of sabotage. If you look at the political arena, distraction is one of the most powerful tools. If you look at the media, distraction is one of the most powerful tools, right? It's like, oh, Jeffrey Epstein and his black book, all right, we'll just start a war or something. Like, there's always something that can be done. Oh, look over here, to distract people from more important things. What do you think about this, Jens?
I think it's Edward Bernays that wrote the book about propaganda. The truth is that I think that we may get distracted for a short period of time, but the actual truth is the truth. So at some point, right, these distractions cannot go on forever. Now, granted, you could give the argument that fiat money enables these distractions forever. You could make that argument. But I also think that, at least in the Bitcoin space, I feel as though these arguments seem to fall apart a lot faster. And what I'm thinking of right now is stuff like the block size war to a certain extent. They were allowed to, you know, they were able to make a lot of noise. The New York agreement made a lot of noise. And for at that time, I was a noob. And, you know, for a very short period of time, I was captured by it, but it quickly derailed because Bitcoin is, right? Bitcoin was there, and it's that meter stick that just doesn't move. So it just falls apart. So, but yeah, I think that, you know, that does hit the nail on the head. We were talking about CTV, and poof, all of a sudden everybody's just arguing about JPEGs and block size again and pretending like it's a whole big problem all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing that's really annoying is that a lot of VC money is entering, and they're the ones that are, like, kind of pumping this distraction. I mean, they're hoping for it to be a pump and dump, but, you know, for a lot of altcoiners, this is like a way to troll Bitcoin and say, see, we can put this stuff, you're not centralized, you're vulnerable to this stuff. And I mean, of course, they're going to run out of money doing that. But this is where the money's coming from, is fiat 2.0 altcoins. And this is what's funding a lot of this stuff. whether through VCs or whatever, they made probably, you know, 30x on some pump and dump, and they're putting a little bit of money into this, seeing if it'll pump and dump. But ultimately, it's taking a lot of Bitcoin resources and making, you know, node running harder and so on. It's a really sad state of things, but this is what they're doing.
It's absolutely right. And I just want to add, Udi and Eric got $6.5 million for doing, you know, as investment into, like, think about that. Like, who gives? And it just goes to show you how unimportant the money is and how valueless it is that somebody's willing to throw over $6 million at freaking pointers to JPEGs. Like,
well, and then Luke, of course, got a similar amount. Luke got a similar amount for Ocean, I don't know if it's the same number, but again, like, yeah, there's various money being thrown at various projects. I think I've forgotten his name now. The developer of CTV, Jeremy Rubin. He's like, well, where's my millions? And I think David Bailey actually responded saying, oh, well, you know, where's the token or something like this, or like, I'll give you the money and my wife won't let me, or, you know, like, because there's no obvious pump and dump. But Jimmy, you mentioned shitcoiners think they're highlighting a vulnerability. Well, it doesn't help when then someone reports a vulnerability into the national vulnerability database as a national security interest, right? And here you see, you know, some commentary from our friend Shinobi. Do you think this entry was made by a Bitcoiner who's scared about ordinals, or is this just part of the shitcoiners, actually undermine some of the essence of Bitcoin?
Yeah, I have no idea whether it's like a well-meaning pleb or, you know, somebody outside the space just sort of like, trying to make Bitcoiners look bad. But I mean, this what happens with like open reporting systems, is that you get, you know, anyone can do it, probably somebody will. So I don't put much stock in that or whatever. It's a rando doing something. And like the trap that a lot of altcoiners will try to put you in as a Bitcoin maximalist is, hey, like, you need to defend this guy that's also a Bitcoin maximalist, because what they said or whatever. It's like, no, I don't. They're their own person. And they're like, I don't speak for them. I'm not their leader. And that's like, somebody did that. I don't know if it was a Bitcoin maximalist or not. You have no obligation to defend them. And you have no obligation to answer for it. And you have no obligation to talk about it or anything, because it's something some random person did. Have that person answer. And, if we find out who did report it, then go ask. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. And, as a group, we're a decentralized group. And you don't have to answer for anybody else or anything like that.
Very well.
Final story for Rec this week. It's Ledger, but if you're still using Ledger, well, you're a fucking idiot, quite frankly. There are many, many better signing devices. Cold Card, Jade from Blockstream. Like, there's a whole bunch of things. Seed Signer, right, is another signing device, and there's lots of options that are Bitcoin only. And if you're using non Bitcoin only tools to try and secure your Bitcoin, and then if you're logging into dApps and trying to get yield, like, come on, like, you should know better. You should know better.
Yes, you definitely should. I'll go ahead, Jimmy.
I mean, I think y'all know what I'm going to say. Yeah. Like, this is stupid. Yeah, like, we've there's so many distractions. This is why, like, it's a little bit dangerous to follow everything like on a day-to-day basis, and why you need to like pick up other hobbies and go do something else, or go raise a family, have some kids, do something for your long-term benefit rather than like pay attention to a lot of this stuff, because in a sense you can always be enraged in this like constant online world if you want to be. Mm-hmm. but that's not necessarily good for you. And, you know, a lot of this stuff is, you know, crafted so that it will enrage you and get your emotions up and stuff. And you find yourself like emotionally spent and doing something else. So, yeah, don't worry about a lot of this stuff. Just, you know, hold and live life rather than letting this stuff kind of take over your life.
I think I found Jimmy's alt account because I shared this tweet earlier today. And in the spirit of what he's saying, right, if what you're consuming online doesn't make you wealthier, smarter, happier, calmer, reconsider the way you're spending the time in front of your phone and computer, because time online should only make your real life better. And that's going to wrap this section of Wrecked.
Up next, we are moving it on over to the Hopium.
The Hopium.
The Hopium is brought to you by CipherSafe. Check them out at ciphersafe.io. You need to secure your seed. You need to store your seed. Check out the Cypher Grid that comes with this awesome little punch tool at ciphersafe.io. If you appreciate fine Bitcoin art, check out the Bitcoin Rollo Triangle at ciphersafe.io. 16 ounces of solid titanium made by a Bitcoiner for fellow Bitcoiners. That's the Bitcoin Rollo Triangle at ciphersafe.io. For the Hopium, you know what's kind of interesting is that this week had no shortage of Hopium, but also no shortage of debate and anger and aggression. It was really, really crazy. Anyways, let's dive into it. Here is a tweet from Daniel Batten. Walton, thank you very much for sharing this one. So here we go. He goes, I just about fell off my chair. And what is he talking about? This document over here, which, by the way, isn't all that rosy because they talk a lot about equity in there anyways. But look, this is the piece that people are all hopeful about. It's right here. Beyond COP28, a fresh look at Bitcoin's ESG credentials. Could BTC be ESG? A recent rise in the Bitcoin price is reviving a debate on whether the digital currency could be considered an ESG investment. The recent growth is coming on the heels of a possible approval of spot Bitcoin ETF as early as next month, because of course, right, when the really big money get behind something, all of a sudden the narratives, poof, they magically change and things, they just become good for you. That's what it is. So to me, honestly, this is just a giant nothing burger. This is just totally expected out of mainstream media because, hey, now all of a sudden Bitcoin going to make the right people the right money and it's good. You know, so I don't know. Anyways,
I think this guy's more impressed that he himself got quoted, but it does mark a change for the Financial Times who have been very anti Bitcoin in many articles.
Yeah, absolutely.
100%.
Okay. Moving on. This goes back to the conversation that we've been having about the ordinals, about the ridiculous block size. This is a tweet from Guy Swan. So here we go. Did you know in June 2014, a mining pool called Ghash.io obtained over 50% of the Bitcoin network entirely by itself? The community basically lost their minds. Somehow this had snuck up on them. When it became a huge public issue, miners shifted away in the following months in droves until Ghash was a very small portion of the whole network. They eventually shut down completely in 2016. Just so you know, nothing is new. I mean, I think that this is kind of the point, right? This even goes back to, so this in particular has to do with people arguing about Bitcoin only having quote unquote two pools, right? Two mining pools, even though there's 12, but supposedly the two main ones are actually owned by the same group. So that's what this has to do with, but it also goes towards the grift of the ordinals, right? There was Counterparty once upon a time. There was also BitDNS once upon a time. It's not to say that these ideas won't happen, right? It's not to say that they won't happen. They will, but right now there's a lot of noise, but it doesn't mean they're as significant as people are making them out to be. You know, so anyways, I just wanted to put that in the Hopium segment to remind everybody, you know, and Jimmy, I wasn't around in the Counterparty days. Do you have any comments or anything about that time?
I mean, this was like the entire color coins era and everything else. But it was It was this dream of being able to mint shitcoins ad infinitum. So that was realized, I think, way more on the Ethereum network. But ultimately, this, you know, it's just like this growing collection of stupid things that people pay for pump and dumps. And, you know, continues today with these spam coins on the Bitcoin network.
Yeah.
There's still people actually using Counterparty. I met some artists that are still using Counterparty. I think it's wild, but, you know.
Yes.
Collectors will collect all sorts of things, and people who want to sell stuff to collectors will sell stuff to collectors.
Yeah, they just shouldn't sell it to them as an investment. I have no problem with people. I'm a collector, agreed. But nobody sits there and tells me, Phil, this thing's going to be worth $1 million. It's like, no, you don't, you know, I just want this thing because I want it. Anyways, let's move on to the ETF Hopium. You know, as if we weren't sick enough of it already. And it's funny, we've gotten comments in the YouTube in the show where they're like, I don't want to hear about the ETF anymore. It's like, guys, we at the very least, we have to keep people up to date on the confusion and excitement. Okay, even if we agree or disagree with it. So here we go. This is a tweet from BTC Therapist, and it's a snap footage of Gary Gensler being interviewed. And I gotta say, I don't know, Gary. I feel like Gary's doing some cope here or something. Let's dive into it.
Obviously, the commission and the staff of the commission is still hard at work on a number of issues. One of them being dealing with a number of filings of spot Bitcoin ETFs. You know, Mr. Chair, I have to ask you this question. There has been a lot.
I suspected we did something very significant about the $26 trillion treasury market, mm-hmm. which is really the base of our entire capital markets.
He's coping.
It's how we fund our government. It's how our Federal Reserve does monetary policy. It's how we maintain the dollar dominance around the globe. And you want to ask me about crypto?
In my defense, Commissioner Ueda also brought up crypto in this open meeting.
Priorities. I mean, the U.S. Treasury market is a very consequential, very important market. Crypto securities are not only much smaller, it's not how we fund our government. Mm-hmm. It's not how we conduct monetary policy. And for many...
Okay, Gary's coping. Okay, right there. Like, this is what, and you see what he did there, right? Because she asked about Bitcoin. He talked about crypto. That right there is, in my eyes, just a bit of a, you know, like that's done on purpose, right?
As that Jimmy said meant, earlier, right? It's all about politics. It's all about politics.
That's exactly right. Okay, so, anyways, to wrap up the new information on the ETF, this was a tweet from Humble Warrior. BlackRock has quietly adjusted its landmark Bitcoin spot exchange traded fund application to allow Wall Street giants such as JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs. I'm not actually applauding this. So let's take a look at the article. The world's largest asset manager that looks after around $10 trillion on behalf of clients updated its Bitcoin spot ETF filing to allow Wall Street banks to act as authorized participants. And I'll explain what that means, allowing them to bypass restrictions that prevent them from holding Bitcoin and crypto on their own balance sheets. That makes it sound good, but there's more to this shit. If the SEC accepts this revised dual model of create and redeem with cash and physical, that means the liquidity that supports the ETF shares when they trade would be increased because obviously you would have more potential authorized participants as part of the process. The reason I am calling bullshit on this, I know it sounds amazing to the fiat maximalists, right? The people who really only see Bitcoin in terms of its fiat value. But if you ask me, this is the kind of part of the trick to essentially turn Bitcoin into gold, so to speak, right? Because essentially what this does, what they're not explaining here is that these institutions can go and provide cash, okay, supposedly to BlackRock, and then they will be able to issue more shares of the ETF. So number one, BlackRock never really has to take possession of the cash. Right. Number two, does BlackRock have any obligation to actually buy the Bitcoin on the open market that they are creating these new shares from the supposed cash that they're? I mean, look, I am not a financial expert. I don't pretend to be. I'm a pleb. And to me, this sounds fucking grift. I don't know. Jimmy, what are your thoughts?
Hey, it's possible. Like, there's this the cash part. may inflate the supply in some way, unless like you see a lot of redemptions and so on. But even there, they actually have to sell on market. Like the thing seems designed so that the fiat printers have some option later to sort of manipulate it heavily on their own terms, which is ironic because their concern has always been, hey, it's too manipulable an asset. Really, what they meant was, we want the ability to manipulate it whenever. So I don't know. It's a strange one, and it's possible that we get a large bump after the ETF, and then it stays steady because it gets managed by, entities that have access to infinite money.
Right. Absolutely. It's like, why are there futures ETFs but not spot ETFs? It's because the futures ETFs, by and large, I think there are some exceptions, like maybe Deribit or something like this, but most futures funds are cash settled, not Bitcoin settled. So it means that they can be manipulated more. Jimmy's right here. It's about control. And good luck to them. Not really, actually, but like but this is why individuals need to be taking self-custody, because the more self-custody we have, the less this sort of thing can happen, right? I'm sure the bankers probably looked at FTX and went, hey, we'd like to do some of that. But you can't if everyone takes self-custody.
Yep, absolutely. And of course, this is why they'll demonize self-custody. And guys, this wraps up the Hopium. It also wraps up the Pleb Underground show for this week. Jimmy, before we sign off again, how do the viewers find you and your new book, Fiat Ruins Everything?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, at Jimmy Song. You can find me on Stacker News. My username there is also Jimmy Song, and it has a link to my Noster pub key that you can go and go find me on Noster as well. But yeah, you can find my book on Amazon, fiatruinseverything.com, and Bitcoin Magazine.
Amazing. And like I said before, we will put all of that in the show notes. Guys, don't forget to like and subscribe. Help us grow the channel. Don't forget to check us out on our audio-only platforms, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. If you want to stream us sats, check us out on Fountain.fm. You could stream us sats through Breeze. Walton, how do we wrap this one up?
Fuckshitcoins.com. Please like and subscribe. We will see you next week.
Peace.